I'm Paul Kohler. I'm the Liberal Democrat candidate for Wimbledon.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Paul, for answering my questions today. Just to begin with, tell me a bit about yourself, why you're standing to be Wimbledon's local MP, and what you think you could bring to the constituency.
Okay, of course. My day job, I'm a legal academic. I have been so for some 40 years. I'm also a bar owner in central London, the only academic I suspect you know who also owns a bar in central London. I'm not a career politician by any means. And 10 years ago, I was simply that, a legal academic with a bar. 10 years ago, I was attacked in my own home by four thugs. They beat me very badly, and my life was saved by two brave police officers from Wimbledon Police Station who didn't wait for backup, as they were told to do, rushed through the door and jumped on one of the attackers literally as he was about to dispatch me with a heavy wooden door that had fallen off in the melee, which was about to bring down on my head. So I was saved by these police officers. My attackers happened to be Polish. This was in 2014.
Yeah.
And the right-wing media made a lot of this. They made the point that they were from the EU, and they used it in an anti-EU, anti-immigrant, anti-Polish agenda. That really annoyed me. In the Brexit campaign, one of the Brexit campaigns used my story to again push an anti-EU agenda. I was very much pro the EU. This really angered me. A little while later, Sadiq Khan decided to close the police station from whence my saviours had come. And so I'm annoyed with the right for how they misused my story. I'm a lot annoyed with Sadiq Khan for how he's trying to close my police station. I'm shouting at the television. My wife says, for goodness sake, stop shouting at the TV, go out and do something. And one of my daughters said, Dad, why don't you join me in the Lib Dems? And so I did. And so I became a Lib Dem member in 2017, stood for council in 2018, and won Trinity, as it then was, for the first time ever as a Lib Dem. I'm stood for Parliament in 2019, where we came within 628 votes of beating the Tories, becoming the closest Lib Dem Tory margin in the country. And now I'm standing again to finish the job. So that's the historic background of how I got into this. What I want to do for Wimbledon is I want to stand up for the local environment, particularly to stop sewage being pumped into our local rivers. I want to fight the ALTC's plans to turn much of Wimbledon Park into an industrial tennis complex. I want to fight for local health services. We need a cancer screening site in Wimbledon. We need a primary healthcare hub in the Maldons, a campaign that Ed Davey started, and now that's coming into Wimbledon constituency, so I will take over that campaign. And I'm still fighting to keep children's cancer services at St George's. And lastly, very dear to my heart, I want to improve community policing. Wimbledon Police Station is still under threat. I took the Mayor of London to court to stop it closing in 2018. I won that case, but for 6 years, he has refused to give a guarantee about its long-term future. And in the Evening Standard, only this week, it was said that they were going to close police stations in London. Any borough with two police stations would have one closed. Wimbledon is one of only two or three with two police stations because of my court action. And so it means, of course, Wimbledon is under threat again.
Yeah.
So those are my priorities locally.
Okay, great. So, yeah, you've outlined your local priorities, and it's a lot of the things that we're going to get into talking about now in more detail. So let's begin. You've just touched on a bit there about the River Wandle and about clean water. I believe Thames Water is talking about continuing sewage dumping in the River Wandle for another 10 or so years. So my first question simply, is your party committed to cleaning up dirty water locally, which I think you've slightly answered there already?
We most certainly are. This is absolutely obscene that raw sewage is pumped into our waterways and our chalk streams and other waterways. It's quite wrong. Thames Water pumped 14 billion litres of sewage into the Thames last year. That's 14,000 million litres. And that needs to stop. But Thames Water is in crisis. It has £18 billion worth of debt and is on the verge of administration. In March, Sarah Olney, the MP for Richmond Park, put a bill before Parliament to place Thames Water into special administration because we're very concerned about it. To allow water companies to borrow money to pay dividends, but not invest in our clearing up our waters is quite wrong. I own a small business in central London. If I went to the bank and said, "Can I borrow money to pay dividends?" The bank would rightly say, "No, of course not." But yet that's what Thames Water and others have been allowed to do. So we want to radically change the ownership model of water companies. We want to turn into public benefit companies. This is an American concept. Ben and Jerry's, the ice cream manufacturers, you will know, they're a public benefit company. They are profit making, but it also means they have wider terms of association and they have public benefit goals as well as just making profit for shareholders. We need to turn water companies into that. We also need to increase the regulation. Ofwat clearly doesn't have the power to do so. We want to create a new authority called the Clean Water Authority that will stop them paying dividends and stop them paying bonuses when they're not cleaning up our rivers.
I did have a I had a look at the Lib Dems manifesto costings. You've spoken there about sort of strengthening regulators or creating a whole new regulator with maybe stronger powers. I did also see there was a plan to introduce a sewage tax on water company profits. Some people might say that instead of taxing profits, wouldn't it be better to regulate the profits so that they're reinvested into infrastructure, and then in that way you're more dealing with the cause of the sewage dumping rather than the symptoms. So rather than going, you're dumping sewage, we're going to impose this tax, it's about getting there in the first place.
I don't think it's an either or. I think what we're saying is there will be tougher regulation. Part of that regulation will be on how much dividend, how much profit they're allowed to make. And I think to concentrate the minds of shareholders, there should also be a tax, a sewage tax on the profit they would get to concentrate their mind on the fact that the sewage isn't being remedied or the sewage dumping isn't being remedied. So we're not saying they should make a profit. We're not saying the shareholders shouldn't get some of that profit, but we're saying that profit should be reduced to in recognition of the fact that sewage is still being dumped. So it's not either or, it's a bit of both.
Okay. And you've also spoken about Thames Water being very in debt, which I think is kind of at the heart of this issue. Are water companies in debt? And Thames Water specifically is saying that they have enough funds to keep themselves solvent for another year, but they're simultaneously proposing a 40% hike in water charges over the next 5 or 6 years. Some people will argue, I spoke to the local Green candidate a few days ago. They're arguing, in some ways, water privatisation has actually failed, and state ownership of Thames Water is an inevitable next step. I was just wondering what your thoughts were on that.
Well, we are where we are. Without a doubt, water privatisation was wrong. It was a stupid thing to do by the Conservatives. Natural monopolies, turning them into private companies, clearly has problems. But we are where we are. Nationalising would cost a vast amount of money
Yes, yeah.
and won't solve the problem.
Right.
Problem is sewage dumping. What we need to do is tougher regulation and getting the shareholders to focus on what they need to do. They've taken dividends, now they have to actually be part of the solution. And that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah. Okay, great. I think we'll move on to the next issue now. We've covered quite a lot of Thames Water there, which is brilliant. So the next issue is very pertinent to those people living and working in London. The ultra low emission zones, it's more commonly known as ULEZ. It's the largest clean air zone in the world. It operates across all London boroughs. It charges drivers of certain vehicles a £12.50 daily charge to drive within the zone. So criticisms have been made that in some ways this policy is quite unfair. So for example, for the people living outside of London who are commuting in, they are subject to the ULEZ charge, but they didn't get a say in the vote you know, in it being voted in because they weren't participating in the mayoral election. They also aren't afforded the benefits of the scrappage scheme that people living in London have access to. So your party broadly supports the policy, I believe. What are your views on the implementation of the scheme?
Almost 10,000 people a year die because of air pollution in London. We need to address that. We need cleaner air. It's one of the most polluted cities in the world. But ULEZ has been brought in a wholly incorrect way, which has simply annoyed people and caused unnecessary hardship, particularly to those on lower wages. What we argued for was that there should be a longer transition period, so people had longer to address the situation with their own cars. There should be a more generous scrappage scheme, and the government simply failed to fund it. The government has funded scrappage schemes in places like Birmingham, but refused to do so in London, purely for political reasons. So yes, we believe in the concept of ULEZ. What we don't believe in the way it was implemented, that was badly done by the Mayor of London with no help from the government. It was turned into a political issue.
So it's sort of about, for example, maybe having longer lead-in times so people have longer to adapt to the scheme, to update to newer vehicles, stuff like that?
Well, exactly. You need longer lead-in times. And you have to remember, lots of the people who've been punished by ULEZ bought diesel cars when they were told they were saving the planet. Only a few years ago, Everyone was telling them diesel cars are good for the environment. They've spent a lot of money on diesel cars. Now they're told, no, they're not good for the environment. And they're being punished with ULEZ. And the scrappage scheme was clearly inappropriate. What we need to do with green measures is not punish people for past decisions, particularly past decisions in good faith. What we need with green measures is to reward them for new decisions. And so the ULEZ, the way it was implemented, looked like it was punishing people for innocent mistakes made when they thought they were doing right. That cannot be correct.
Some people might say that air pollution in London is breaching legal limits, and these are limits which were meant to be met a decade ago. And it's a climate emergency. A climate emergency requires immediate, drastic action and decision making. And that perhaps Labour are doing what's best in ripping the band-aid off, as it were. And also there's the argument that, you know, there were delays already. You know, we're talking about longer lead-in times, but there were delays to the implementation scheme because COVID and lockdowns, that kind of afforded people potentially enough notice to start thinking about updating their vehicles.
Well, remember it was post-COVID when the actual, you know, decision was made to actually implement it. People were given very little time. Well, when Boris Johnson first brought in the ULEZ zone, people were given 3 years' notice. They didn't have that sort of notice this time. Yeah. But I agree, there is an urgency about these things. But if it was going to be done overnight, as it almost was done, the scrappage scheme should have been far more generous. Yeah. And should have been extended to those who drive into London. Mm-hmm. It was a far too narrow a scrappage scheme. And clearly, it's hugely unfair to people in London, particularly parts of London where transport is not good, yes. where they need their cars. Now, in the centre of Wimbledon, transport is very good. But even in my borough, if you go to New or Old Morden, transport is not nearly as good. Whilst we have poor public transport, people need their cars. If they need their cars, they shouldn't be punished for having cars that contravene ULEZ when they bought them in good faith, thinking they were saving the planet. So, yes, there's an urgency about this, but the scrappage scheme should have reflected the fact of that urgency and been more generous.
So it's just about making it more fair and more accessible.
Politics is about compromise and fairness. You want a fairer society, and that involves compromise at every level, of course.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to social care and the NHS. And I wanted to, first of all, actually focus on one of the local hospitals. It's not in the Wimbledon constituency, but it serves a lot of Wimbledon residents. So I have a few statistics sort of to set the scene here about St George's Hospital in Tooting that I wanted to put to you. So The CQC's current rating of the hospital is that it requires improvement. Last year, maternity services were deemed inadequate, the issue being that there are not enough staff to keep mothers and babies safe. I had a look at the BBC's NHS tracker. Ambulances at St George's are queuing for twice as long as they should be. Patients are waiting longer in A&E than the target time of 4 hours. And they're also waiting longer than the target time of 18 weeks for routine treatment. I don't think this is a reflection, you know, of how kind of hardworking and brilliant the staff at St George's are, but I do think it's a picture that's indicative of a wider crisis going on nationally in the NHS and social care. So simply, how are you and your party planning on ensuring the recovery of the NHS and social care?
With regard to the NHS, we clearly need to pay our staff properly, and that's an issue. On the particular issue you just mentioned then about the shortage of staff, one of the big issues around St George's is the lack of affordable accommodation nearby as well.
Yeah.
So things like community land trusts are important to provide truly affordable housing for people. With regard to the NHS itself, we need to end the bed blocking. Some 13 different estimates, between 13 and 18,000 beds are blocked in hospitals because people cannot be released to their homes because they have inadequate personal care at home. So one of the big policies of the Lib Dems is to provide free home personal care cover so that you can get people out of hospital where they're simply bed blocking and into the home. That will free up many, many beds and, of course, will help the throughput of patients and will start addressing the terrible weight and the huge waiting lists we currently have. With regard to, you know, that's the back door. We've got to sort the back door out. We've also got to sort out the front door of the NHS, and that's GPs. We have real difficulties in Wimbledon, people getting to a GP appointment. It's very, very difficult to do so. You get on the 8 o'clock phone and you queue it. You wait in a long, long queue and hope there's an appointment left for you by the time your call is answered. We need to employ more GPs. The plan that the Lib Dems have, a costed plan to employ 8,000 new GPs. That means training more, it means retaining more. And again, we have a costed plan to do that. We need more GPs out there. And of course, they can nip issues in the bud. If you see your GP early enough, things might not progress. You might not need to go to hospital. Often the GP is not being used in that role because there's no continuity of care, because there's not enough GPs. And so people end up in A&E with huge wait times, of course.
Yeah. So what you're kind of referring to there, and I've heard the Lib Dems before using this nice analogy of the front door and the back door. I think it's been kind of increasingly recognised that it's not all about pumping money directly into hospitals. It's about being intelligent with investment and investing in the right areas, relieving pressure off hospitals by investing into frontline care, general practitioners, dentists, mental health facilities. So I'm sure there's an emphasis from you and from the Lib Dems on recovering frontline care.
Yes. If you just pump money in without being strategic about how you pump it, you risk wasting it. Preventive care is clearly crucial. That's why we want the Diagnostic Centre in Wimbledon for Cancer. And likewise, spending £2 billion on improving or offering free home personal care is far better money spent than putting that £2 billion straight into the NHS, because freeing up those hospital beds and that valuable resource, it is hugely cost efficient, of course.
Tell me more about, you've mentioned at the beginning and just there again about these, is it the diagnostic centres or the cancer centres? This is part of a plan that you're quite passionate about.
Yes, because Wimbledon clearly has a deficit here. We don't have a cancer diagnostic centre here. We need one. It's clearly important. As you know, early diagnosis and treatment of breast cancer is absolutely crucial.
Yes.
Having diagnostic centres within easy reach, it is clearly important. Yeah. And it's a clear deficit in what we have in the Wimbledon area, and something we must invest in.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to now to policing, local policing, which I know, as you've already explained, it's something which is very close to your heart. I believe all the main parties have promised investment in community policing to some extent, putting, you know, neighbourhood officers back on the streets. You've, as you said at the beginning, you've been campaigning to save Wimbledon Police Station since 2017, when Sadiq Khan first announced plans for its closure. Just to get a bit of clarification, because I was having a look online, and I know you were talking about kind of the progress being made with saving the police station earlier on in the discussion. It is quite hard to see exactly what the current status of that the police station is. Is it something where if you become Wimbledon's local MP, you will want to be really cementing its place in Wimbledon?
Whether I do indeed hope to become Wimbledon's MP, but even if I wasn't, I would be fighting for the police station. It's absolutely critical to our community. Yes, you are right. In 2018, in my judicial review, my legal action against the Mayor of London, the High Court quashed his order to close the police station. So it stopped the closure. What it hasn't done is guaranteed its long-term future. That was in 2018 when I won that court case. Mm. We're 6 years on. My colleagues on the London Assembly, Caroline Pigeon, who at the time, and Hina Bakari, pushed the mayor repeatedly to give guarantees about the long-term survival of the police station. He hasn't done so. Mm. And as I say, in this week's Evening Standard, the mayor is talking about closing another four police stations in areas where a borough has more than one police station. Well, ever since I won my court case, Merton has had two police stations, one in Wimbledon, one in Merton. So Wimbledon is again under threat. Yeah. And so we are pushing now, we will continue to push the mayor to guarantee the long-term future of Wimbledon Police Station.
Other than the police station, you know, what are your plans to make people in Wimbledon safer in general, but also feel safer? Because I think regardless of the crime statistics for the area, I think public perception of safety is really important.
It is. You know, it's important to note that Merton is one of the safer boroughs in London. I don't want to add to a fear of crime, but muggings are up, car theft is up, and people don't see enough police officers on the street. And it's all very well pledging to have more police officers, but the reality is often very different. You know, since 2015, we've lost a third of the community police in London. We've lost a third of our community police officers. That's ridiculous. And the Tories often talk about adding 20,000 new police officers. Well, they did, but at the same time, they cut 30,000 backroom staff. Mm. So many of the new police officers are doing the backroom work that used to be done by backroom staff. So the Tories have achieved the amazing sort of feat of increasing police officers and removing more from the beat. It's quite ridiculous. Yeah. What we need is police officers on the streets. That means employing more backroom staff to do the backroom work that doesn't require trained police officers to do it, and more frontline people on the street being employed as well. Again, we have a costed plan to do that because people need the reassurance of seeing a police officer walking by. And that's why we need police officers on the street. It's also why we need police stations and police hubs, because if police aren't based in their community, you can't have community of policing, a point made in the Casey report.
Mm. Okay, let's, just because I'm conscious of time, let's move on to the cost of living crisis, which is a really broad issue. It basically underpins everything I'm speaking to you about today. We have heard a lot recently about how the parties are looking to tackle economic challenges on a national level. Some of these challenges, people may argue, have stemmed in part from 14 years of austerity, which is a policy your party supported in coalition with the Cameron Osborne government. That aside, how are you planning on supporting residents in Wimbledon who are struggling financially?
It's a real issue for residents in Wimbledon. This might be one of the richest constituencies in the country, but on government statistics, 38% of households in Wimbledon are described as deprived. So there's huge issues, even in somewhere like Wimbledon. Yeah. And there's a number of things we need to do. To deal with poverty and children's poverty in particular, we need to remove the two benefit cap. The two benefit cap, as the Child Poverty Action Group said, is causing huge poverty, and the easiest way of addressing child poverty would be to remove that. And the Lib Dems have a costed plan to do so. Neither of the other two parties will address that. It has to be addressed, and that's absolutely crucial. With regard to the economy, we have to grow the economy, and ultimately that requires us to re-engage with Europe, and thus on a macro level what we must do as a country is re-engage with Europe. And again, the Lib Dems have a four-stage plan to rejoin the single market. That is utterly crucial because we need to engage with our closest neighbours. We need to improve trade. We need to grow the economy, because the only way ultimately to address the cost of living crisis is to grow the economy. Both Labour and Tory talk about growing the economy, but you dig a little deeper and ask them what their plans are. They don't have any plans. Re-engaging with Europe must be part of that process, and that's crucial to us. We also need an industrial strategy to help guide how outside investors invest in the country and how the government invests in the country as well. So we need an investment strategy. We need to re-engage with Europe, and we need to address obvious failings like the two benefit cap.
Yeah. And re-engagement with Europe, I think, you know, people think that re-engagement with Europe would require another referendum and for us to rejoin the EU. But actually, it's about moving as a country. We can get a closer relationship while still being outside of the EU.
Yeah, that's important. We're not, you know, in our manifesto, we say our long-term aim one day is to rejoin the EU. But that cannot happen overnight. We're not talking about that at this stage. We're talking about a four-stage plan to go back into the single market. That means realigning our regulatory positions so that, of course, it's easier to trade between our bloc and the UK and the EU. But it's a staged process. We need to first gain their trust. At the moment, we look like scoundrels who can't be trusted. We need to go fire a number of steps. As a university academic, it's very important to me we rejoin the Erasmus Plus scheme. It was open to us. We refused to accept it. We need to go into things like that, build up that trust, and slowly get to a point where we can re-enter the single market, like somewhere like Norway is already in that position. But we're not talking about joining the EU overnight. It simply wouldn't work. They wouldn't have us either.
I'm going to move from a very broad issue now to a much narrower, much more specific issue to the local area. And I'll wrap up the interview on this topic as well, if that's all right. So it's an issue of considerable importance to residents in the north of the constituency. So the All England Tennis Club is proposing, and we, you know, you mentioned this earlier as well, they're proposing to build a tennis complex, which includes a major stadium on what was until recently Wimbledon Park's golf course. So a lot of local residents are really unhappy about the proposal. They're arguing it's going to harm the historic heritage of the park, it's going to harm the biodiversity of the area. The club is arguing that they're turning an area of previously private land into a year-round public park, and in that way they're increasing the green space available to local communities. So I'd be really keen to hear your thoughts on the development. I think this is an issue that has the potential to sway some of the voters in that area of the constituency.
Yeah, the All England Club's plans are grossly, they're just simply wrong. They're overdeveloping and turning a large swathe of Wimbledon Park into an industrial tennis complex. When they bought the freehold of that land from the council in 1993, they gave solemn undertakings, as did the council, the land would never be built upon. They are legally binding undertakings, covenants that said they wouldn't build on the land. Now they're trying to build on the land. Yes, we love the tennis. Yes, we're proud of the tennis. Yes, we want the tennis to continue to be hugely successful. That does not require building on a large piece of metropolitan open land. And remember, this is green space. This is the lungs of London, this metropolitan open land. And they are suggesting they want to, let's go through it. They want to build a 10-story stadium, over 9 kilometres of roads, 10 outbuildings and 38 tennis courts, which are grass covered, but they underneath them is just concrete. That's gross overdevelopment. And it, all we are saying to the All England Club is meet with the community. Let's agree a compromise. Yes, we want the tennis to continue to be successful, but this is gross overdevelopment. And my party, as a Lib Dem, we've been pressing the Labour Council, Merton's Labour Council, to say that it will enforce the promises made in 1993. As you know, the Labour majority on the planning committee in Merton voted through the planning permission. Wandsworth thankfully said no. It's now gone to the Mayor of London. He's had to recuse himself because he's already spoken in favour of the development. But a decision is awaited. Well, we don't know when that will be. What I'd say to everyone is, even if the All England Club finally get planning permission, the covenants are still binding. The covenants entered into in 1993 are still binding, but the only person who can enforce those covenants is Merton Council. And twice now, I have put a motion to Merton Council asking them to enforce the covenants. And both times, my opponent, my Labour opponent in this election, Eleanor Stringer, as deputy leader of the council, has voted with the other Labour councillors and voted down our motions. The way to stop the overdevelopment, the way to bring the All England Club to the negotiating table is simply to say, yes, the covenants will be enforced. And those are watertight. In my day job, I'm a property lawyer. There's a case absolutely to point on exactly the terms of a covenant like that in Oxford. And the court said, clearly, you can't build a stadium when the covenants say you can't build on the land. All we need to do is enforce the covenants, even if they get planning permission. And that's something I've been pushing since 2021, when I joined the Save Woman and Park Group in fighting this gross overdevelopment.
It's an interesting issue, isn't it? Because I think a lot of people living around Wimbledon Park, you know, they could have been here for decades and will have never had any access to that area of land. And, you know, there's a lot of arguments about biodiversity, which move away from public access to parks. But when I was looking into it and doing a bit of research, you know, you're talking about how the land was originally owned. It was leased by the council and it was actually designated as metropolitan open space. So technically, the club is saying it's private land and that the residents are going to get more access than they currently have. But actually, there's a lot of people saying it's not technically private land.
Yeah, let me pick you up on that. There is, and it's too technical to go into detail now, there is an argument the land has always been held on a public trust, in which case, therefore, the public has always had rights in it. And that's a contentious argument that is currently being debated by lawyers. But putting that to one side, when it was used as a golf club, as a resident of Merton, you had rights to use that golf club, even if you weren't a member. So it was always open to the public.
Yeah.
Secondly, all that the All England Club were offering, they keep talking about this park land they're going to create as part of the development. Now, be very careful about this promise. They are making a promise is under what's called a Section 106 agreement. Boringly technical again, I'm sorry. But that promise is to give a small portion of the land they're developing, turn it into a permissive park. Permissive means they can withdraw permission at any time. And secondly, that agreement only lasts for 5 years. So this park they're offering as part of the deal is one where no one has a right to go onto it, unlike the golf club where you did as a Merton resident have a right to go onto it. And secondly, they can change that. They can withdraw that entire park within 5 years. If the All England Club were being honest, if they were making a genuine offer, they would actually give that land to the council. I've asked them repeatedly in meetings, okay, this is your offer. You'll say that we're getting this parkland. Will you give that land to the council so that it's permanently a parkland? And their answer is always no. That shows that this is not a real offer at all. It's simply done to keep people happy. And of course, what they will do in a few years' time is build further upon that land.
Okay. I think we'll leave it on that note. But thank you, Paul, for answering my questions so thoroughly.
Thanks. Sorry, I'm so dosed up. I'm sorry to be
Not at all. And thank you
surface,
for,
but
persevering on with the interview despite your cold. It's very much appreciated. I'm Lucy Knowles, reporting for Radio Jackie.